From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1953 when Walt Disney Studios released the animated Peter Pan. You probably know the story. Plenty of fantasy, swashbuckling pirates, and fairies. But the film is notorious for one of the most bigoted depictions of Native Americans ever seen on film. It even includes a song called What Made the Red Man Red. Hollywood has traditionally portrayed indigenous peoples as tomahawk-wielding savages, ready to attack white characters and their families. For decades, they were used as an entertaining and often unintelligent villain. They were a threat to white women in particular, part of the stereotype. This year, as we approach Indigenous Peoples Day, there is growing buzz for a new film about Indigenous history. Martin Scorsese's new film was a big hit at the Cannes Film Festival, and the acclaimed director says he wanted to tell a tragic American story with as much raw honesty as he could. The film is called Killers of the Flower Moon. It tells the true story of the Osage murders from roughly 100 years ago. Wealthy white men targeted the Osage people after oil was discovered under their land. One of the stars of the film is Leonardo DiCaprio, who said that this is a story that most non-Indigenous Americans don't know, but most Indigenous Americans do. And the film also stars Indigenous actors. It comes on the heels of one of the breakout streaming series, Reservation Dogs, praised widely by critics for its centering modern Indigenous issues and communities. And as one of our guests will explain this hour, storytelling can be powerful. It can be a force for good, but it can also be a destructive force that can do harm. We're going to talk about how these stories are told. Told through the written word, told through film, told perhaps through dance and music, who funds them, what's going on. And as we approach Indigenous Peoples Day, there's a lot to talk about. Let me welcome our guest this hour. Welcome to Lungwa Lagunha. I know them as Loon Doobie. Loon, I want to use the full name accurately, and I apologize because I usually use your shorthand.
Yeah, Loon. That's okay.
So welcome back, Loon. Lungwa Lagunha, how's that?
Yes, that's good.
Okay, great to have you back here.
And thank you.
They're a sensitivity reader for Salt and Sage Books, which thank you for being here as well, Loon. And Kay Gilbert is with us as well. Kay is going to tell us about an event that's coming up in two Sundays from now, coming up at Ganundagan. And it's a great chance for people to experience music, culture. Kay is a retired teacher and a woodwind extraordinario. It's great to have you in studio. Thank you for making time for us, Kay.
Thank you.
So there's a lot to kind of cover and a lot of ground to talk about here. I actually want to start with kind of tying back to yesterday, because when I had a chance to speak to Kay earlier this week, we talked about how this community is attempting to kind of, I don't want to normalize, but kind of get on just the... get into a new habit. In Rochester, there's no more Columbus Day. There's Italian Heritage Day. It's coming up this Sunday. And then there's Indigenous Peoples Day, separate day, two Mondays from now. And Kay, we talked a little bit about what that means to you. And can you start by telling us, sort of how that hits you now? Now we're in the second year of Indigenous Peoples Day in Rochester, what that means to you?
I just think it's really important for this kind of really positive attention that says, listen to what Native American people are saying about their own lives and how they want to be perceived through their own understanding of their own families' histories, their own cultures, their own languages, what's important to them. So recognizing, taking away the history of Columbus, especially with the history of Columbus connected with Native American people, and putting the focus on the positive lives that Native people are living today and how we want our Native children to learn about their cultures and just do so with pride.
Tell us a little bit about your own heritage.
My mother was born and raised in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. I'm a descendant of the Oklahoma Cherokee people.
And when we spoke earlier this week, we talked a little bit about the difference of experience perhaps in modern-day Oklahoma vis-a-vis where we live here. What was your experience with that?
Well, in Oklahoma, there are, I think, 53 federally recognized tribes. Here, of course, we're living amongst the Haudenosaunee people, which are six different separate nations but come together through the Confederacy. And in Oklahoma, there's large chunks of land that are connected with those native tribes. Most of them are not reservations, but they are territorial areas where the tribes are connected. Here, of course, there are reservation territory areas. And they're geographically very separated from each other. But there's such a very strong connection here among the Haudenosaunee people, connecting to each other in many, many different ways. In Oklahoma, there's, of course, a tremendous effort for people to live more healthy lives and have better access to health care and schools and higher education. And the casinos, money has made a huge difference. They're just doing many, many interesting things with that casino money, donating to many things, building wings on hospitals, working towards better education for their children in particular. So it's interesting. It's quite a different attitude both places, but very, very interesting and very welcoming.
How much do you think the average non-Indigenous American knows about the Osage murders in the 1920s?
Pretty close to zero.
Are you surprised to see a Martin Scorsese film focused on that story?
Yes, and I have not seen the film, but I was able to see some trailers online.
They're everywhere now. Yeah, the film hasn't been widely released. It's been at Cannes, it's been at smaller festivals, and it's going to be widely released in October.
I'm really looking forward to seeing it. But there was a particular interview with the director and several of the actors, and I was very impressed with their commitment to really listening to the Osage people and telling the story through their eyes. I was really pleased with the music that I heard. When I think of the old Hollywood films and the drone of the perfect fifth, which is just so heartless and lifeless compared to the way Native music really is, I think people are going to be really surprised to hear that.
Yeah, we'll dig into that more this hour. In fact, Lungwa Lagunha is going to tell us a lot more about sort of the power of storytelling, who's telling the story, how depictions of Indigenous peoples have traditionally sort of come out of Hollywood over the years. And that's part of the role now, as a sensitivity reader for Salt and Sage Books. Tell us a little bit about your work there.
So I'm a sensitivity reader. A lot of my work is consulting on representation, whether it be for Native people, Jewish people, trauma representation. And looking into it as a real power, I would say. Stories have an incredible amount of power in them. We know that a good story can like really touch our hearts and can really like sit with us and teach us lessons. And a bad story can teach like really negative lessons too. Like we can have stories that have negative portrayals of things. And if that is the only understanding of, say, Native peoples, which is, you know, we are still lacking in a lot of representation, negative portrayals of Native peoples will affect people's understanding of us as humans. So my job is generally just to look into the style, look into the type of stories that are being told. And
I guess we're working with authors primarily, right?
Right, yeah.
So print, mostly fiction?
Mostly fiction, yeah.
Okay, and so my assumption is that your line of work didn't exist when Disney rolls out with 1953's Peter Pan and the most, you know, bigoted depictions of Indigenous people. Obviously they didn't care. But I had a conversation this morning with Les Friedman, who's a longtime film writer. He's kind of an encyclopedia of American film. And the way Les described it was that a lot of Hollywood was sort of coming into existence around this time where everyone was excited about what they called manifest destiny, never mind the cultures that were literally being subjected to genocide. Hollywood sort of fell in love with the American adventure moves west, the westerns, the rugged individualism, the adventure. And as Friedman describes it, as time passes, Hollywood has never been obviously very generous to, you know, sort of non-dominant cultures or minority cultures. But when minority cultures or groups gain more power, then Hollywood is more open to telling their stories with perhaps more respect. Indigenous people have not had power in this country. Indigenous people have been sort of dispossessed, and it's a long story of broken treaties and broken promises. And so they're either ignored by Hollywood over time, or when they are depicted at all, they are essentially created as a kind of villain, the threat to the white woman, the rapists, the uncivilized people. And in Friedman's view, it was Hollywood's sort of way of acknowledging its own embarrassment about the way sort of Europeans moved west, wiped out cultures, and then used film to say, well, you know, they were dangerous. You know, that those people were coming for our women. And it's that ugly racist history has gone on for so long. But he is an optimist that this film, in the same way that Kay describes Killers of the Flower Moon, a film that's coming out next month, he's an optimist that things are changing. What do you see when it comes to storytelling's power, and if you think it's actually changing in that regard?
It is. I see with a lot of publishers, them trying to do better, because we do have that history that you explained. I think the push is for authentic representation, which is sort of where our sensitivity reader comes in. It doesn't necessarily need to be a native writer telling these stories. It's best if a native writer is telling these stories, but non-native writers will tell stories with native people in them. And a sensitivity reader's role is to basically try to make sure that the portrayal is as accurate and uplifting as possible. There is a trend in film not just to portray native people as the villain, but also to portray us as spiritual gurus or guides for non-natives.
Like a magical character of, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And you see that with a lot of minority portrayals. And it's not fair because, like, we do have our own, like, you know, desires. We have our own goals and, you know, motivations for doing things. And yes, sometimes that means helping other people because, you know, humans do that. But there is a trend to make that the only motivation of these native characters. And that's not exactly uplifting. It paints this sort of idea that our existence is meant to uplift non-natives or, you know, essentially white people.
Yeah. And let me also kind of press a point that Lin Guadalugunha is raising about authors and who tells stories. You're not saying that, say, take just as an example, a white author. You're not saying a white author can't write indigenous characters into fiction. What I hear you saying is, if you do, do it with care and consult with people who understand culture so you are showing respect.
Right. Yeah. My CEO has a really good rule of thumb where she likes to say that it's called the baby rule. If you know someone of whatever ethnicity and that person will let you hold their baby, they'll also let you hold your stories. And I find that just like a really...
It's really interesting.
Yeah, right? There are definitely like groups of people who like, you know, I'm not particularly well versed in, you know, Asian cultures, just by a matter of fact that like I don't have a whole lot of Asian associates. And therefore, I don't know if I would be comfortable telling a story with Asian people in a way that would be uplifting because it's just not in my wheelhouse. Whereas with Native people, I'm much more confident in that because I have people who will let me look after their children.
Very interesting there. We're going to talk about a lot of things this hour, and we are going to get to some of the first reason that Kay and I were in touch this week with this event that's coming up in a couple of Sundays. I asked Kay what she thinks about Indigenous Peoples Day. What do you think, Loon? The idea of creating this holiday as Rochester had, about 200 American cities have done this now, which is to essentially eliminate the official use of Columbus Day and to instead celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. Rochester now happens to have created through its own Indigenous Peoples Day Committee a separate Italian Heritage Day, separate days, et cetera, not centering Columbus or any one person, but for Indigenous peoples, that will be 2 Mondays from now. That's October 9th. Thank you, because Sunday the 8th is the event at Canonigan. But what do you make of this move towards decoupling and then creating a holiday, Indigenous Peoples Day?
I mean, I think it's a positive. I think decentering Columbus is a really important move. I think the story of Columbus is a really violent, awful story. I mean, the first recorded rape in North America happened from like one of Columbus's men. And that's just like how horrible is, like, you know, there are stories of Columbus's men feeding babies to dogs and just like really awful, terrible atrocities. So I think this push away from Columbus to creating like an Italian Heritage Day and a Native Peoples Day is a very big positive for both our communities.
Okay. You know, you were a school teacher and you taught in a local district. And you taught for how long, by the way?
About 31 years.
About 31 years. So, you know, I certainly, when I was growing up, I got the Thanksgiving story, you know, the everyone's holding hands and it's just so nice. And, oh, it was really, yeah, right. That's the story. There aren't a whole lot of districts that have Indigenous teachers, teachers of Indigenous heritage. I wonder if just your presence in a local district changed a little bit of the way your colleagues taught, whether it was the Thanksgiving story or just typical lessons about history. Did it make an impact, you think?
I think it must have. They were very pleased to be working with me in partnership, and we planned many lessons together. I was at about half of my career as an instrumental music teacher and the other half in the general music classroom. I thoroughly loved both of them and felt I was able to accomplish kind of different things with each. But when I left the general music classroom and went back to teaching instrumental music and looked for Native American music, all I could find was the old Hollywood type, perfect fifths, beating drums, all of that. And I quickly realized that that is not expressing kind of the message I wanted my kids to take away from the experience. So I actually was able to connect with a Native American composer, and I wrote a grant through Teaching Tolerance, which is a part of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And we commissioned this composer, and he wrote a piece for us, which he actually adapted one of his existing pieces. It was called Scenes from Indian Life, and the composer is Dr. Lewis Ballard. And we're playing actually that piece, but another of his pieces on our concert next Sunday. But I wanted my kids to have that experience. It was extremely difficult because while Dr. Ballard considered himself an educator, he had high hopes for my sixth grade band. So we had to work really, really hard to make it happen. But we did. And I wanted them to have context around that. So they had to do research for it, too. So that was one way of really bringing my Native American heritage, but also a deeper experience for those kids into the instrumental program. In the general music classroom, it was much different than that because I could bring in all kinds of tapes and videos and my own regalia and different kinds of experience like that, and work with the classroom teachers around craft projects, art projects, those kinds of things.
Now, it's interesting talking to a music teacher, because when we talk about stereotyping of Native peoples, for example, in books and film, and frankly in classroom lessons, we talk about a number of things, but I don't often hear talk about the music. And what you're telling us is even the music gets stereotyped or even distilled and we're missing a lot of the richness of the heritage. Tell me about that.
Well, when we teach music, we're certainly teaching from a European perspective, and they have to learn scales and arpeggios and all those kinds of things in theory. Do, mi, so, mi, do, all of that. Native music is very different than that. It's not necessarily based around a tonal center, and you don't have a constant, steady beat, although the Hollywood drums would make you think that it is a constant, steady beat. There is sometimes, because obviously we have 2 feet, so if we're dancing to a beat of music, it's 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, over and over and over. But just just a Native music separate from dancing to it is not necessarily a regular beat. It's also often a changing time signature. And so it's interesting even to hear the music and try to write it down. That's quite a challenge too.
When I think about where we often do hear that kind of that drone of a beat and the drum, it's when we see American sports stadiums doing the tomahawk chop for their teams. Mm-hmm. Lingua Laguna just had a visceral reaction. Do you want to explain your reaction there?
Sure.
Loon, get real close to that microphone.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
We see a lot of stereotyping in the sports realm. I mean, the whole Washington team name changed for a really good reason. And then we still see it with, like, the Kansas City Chiefs. I'm not a huge sports fan, so that's really the sum total of the teams that I know. But I do know that there are, like, most mascots you see are animals. And they're, like, you know, animals with, like, a vicious representation. Or, you know, there are also the mascots, like, the Giants that are, like, completely fictitious. Putting Native people as a mascot just doesn't feel good. It's really hard to say that, like, I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to go into my feelings with it just because it's not uplifting. It's like, I'm not looking at these like portrayals of the Kansas City Chiefs and thinking like, hey, there's me. There's like, rather I'm seeing like more of a cartoon portrayal of what a Native person is supposed to be. I don't know if that makes sense.
Sure. Oh, very much so. In fact, I was moved most deeply. I was probably a pretty typical white kid growing up in the suburbs, didn't get a lot of education on this. And I grew up in Cleveland and it was the Cleveland Indians, which is now the Cleveland Guardians. So I didn't think deeply about it until, you know, kind of more of my adult life was underway. And I remember a conversation with Michael Galbin from Ganundagan. I happen to think Michael is brilliant. And he not only told, shared similar sentiments that Luna shared, but shared Michael's own experience growing up in a, you know, mostly white suburban school that had this kind of mascot. And when we talked that day, and this is the better part of a decade ago now, yes, there are some differences within the Native community. People are not a monolith. You will find Indigenous peoples today who say, hey, at least somebody's paying attention to our community, or at least it makes us seem grand or strong. And I see that. I mean, those opinions are out there. There are splits. And if you brought up the Kansas City Chiefs, so there are people in Kansas City who say, look, we've talked to local tribal communities and they're down with this. Like, they're down with the tomahawk chop. And, you know, maybe some are. I was really moved by Michael's testimony on this. And it changed me. It changed how I felt as a Cleveland sports fan with a team called the Indians. And it changed what I wanted to wear on shirts and apparel. And that's why, like, I think the whole cultural war debate about, like, well, all people are so woke now. Travis Kelce's woke because he's dating Taylor Swift, and you know, I didn't know Travis Kelce was woke. Meanwhile, I'm sitting here thinking, like, if anybody can end the tomahawk chop in Kansas City, it's going to be Taylor Swift. She's going to show up. She's going to have to, if she keeps going to his games. I didn't see if she did the chop this time, but I actually am curious about that. Like, and I don't think I'm trying to like woke post. I find it bizarre that we're still doing this. And I never even thought about the music component, but like just that drumpy, that's all we know. Like, that's the extent of what most non-Native kids know about Native music, is it sounds like this. And it's a war chant and it's a war cry and people are chopping tomahawks and they're scalping heads. And like, that's, so I find it cartoonish and hurtful. And mm-hmm. So I am watching that. Anyway, you want to follow up there, Loon?
Oh, no, I'm enjoying
it. Well,
I would like to say...
Kay, I'm curious to know where you are on this. Maybe you've got a totally different view.
Oh, no. I think it's those people out there as mascots that look so foolish. Because Native people don't walk around acting like that.
Well, but that's one of the reasons, and this is, there's been really interesting studies. The most recent one I saw was in 2018. Large numbers of people, up to 40% in a survey, will tell you of Americans, and often American school children, there are no Native Americans living anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, they are a thing of the past, and they always dressed with headdresses and, your kids would say, paint or war paint, you know, those kinds of things. That's part of why that belief exists.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a woke opinion. Like, I find it so distilled and silly that, like, well, are you just on the woke train? Like, that's, I don't even know what that means. Like, we're literally talking about real, actual things here. Anyway,
woke is such a colorful word.
I'm sorry. No, I did not expect to divert in this way in this conversation.
No, it's good. I think it. God, there's a lot that I want to say. I think the interesting thing is talking about how people think that Native peoples aren't around anymore. That was something my dad's first wife shared when they were out on a date. My dad explained he was Native. His first wife eventually laughed and said, that's impossible. They're all dead. And, you know, I hear frequently people look at me and say, like, you don't look Native.
You don't look Native.
Right. And I've heard friends of mine who are very Native looking get told that as well. And it just, like, it's shaped this belief in me that, like, people don't know what we look like. And I think that is a Hollywood trend where, like, we've seen so many portrayals of Native people as, well, cartoons, frankly, or like having been like brushed up in Hollywood makeup to look darker skinned than they are. People just have like a false idea of what Natives, quote unquote, look like. I mean, we existed across North and South America. There are differences.
Of course, yeah.
I'm Northeastern. I look different than, you know, people from the Northwest or the Southeast or Southwest. Just because, like, you know, we come from different areas.
Yeah. By the way, Kay, what do you, before we kind of move on, we're going to talk about this event that Kay's going to be part of coming up. And I do want to kind of go over some of the other depictions of Indigenous people in recent shows. I've never seen Reservation Dogs, but a lot of people I know like it. I'm curious to know if Loon has ideas on, you know, sort of literature. And so there's a lot I want to hit here. But Kay, what do you want to make sure we do understand about, you know, like when we think about concepts of Indigenous music, what are good sources? And how do we think about that differently than just, you know, that war cry, that war chop?
Well, I think it's important, particularly for school people in the schools, music teachers in the schools, to research and find composers who identify as Native. There's a lot in choral music, but also in for instrumental music. There's not a lot available, as far as I know, for the public school level. It's much more at the professional level. But there are more and more Native composers that are really having a lot of success, which I'm very pleased about, having commissions from symphony orchestras and opera companies and ballet companies, things like that.
Kay Gilbert is with us, a longtime music teacher, and still plays plenty of music herself, mm-hmm. right, Kay?
Yes.
And we'll talk in our second half hour about that. Let me just also grab this email from John, who says, I do want to know what your guests' opinions are regarding New York's recent legislation surrounding school names and logos. Canandaigua had to stop using Braves as a nickname. About 20 years ago, the district teamed up with local Native leaders and developed a curriculum that has been taught throughout the school district at all grade levels. Kids learn about the rich history of this area, as well as the creation story from the Haudenosaunee. When local Native Americans were informally polled, many thought the use of the name was used respectfully and were in favor of keeping it, while some others were indifferent and some were against it. Just wondering what your guests think. Yeah, John, I want to uplift one point of this. There is a diversity of opinion, and I'm not an Indigenous person. I can't speak for Loon or Kay's community. I can't do that. I can share my experience growing up in a town that used this kind of mascot and this imagery and getting to my adulthood and thinking, you know, feeling a certain way about it. That's all I can do. I also know there are differences of opinion. And Canandaigua, I think, did have conversations with, you know, everyone from Ganondagan to, you know, local Native leaders, and I don't think there was any single one opinion. But yeah, now you've got legislation that says you can't use it anymore. What do you think, Kay?
Well, I think about my kids in the schools, my Native kids that are maybe in a school with a large Native population, or maybe where they're the only child in the classroom that is Native, and how they feel about this. And I think by not 100%, certainly, but by and large, those kids are really, those families are pretty happy with the change in the logos and the mascots, because they want to be in a place where they feel honored and they don't feel like everybody thinks that they should be dead because they're Native people.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I remember growing up, it was fourth grade. We learned, I grew up down in Florida, and we learned about like the Iroquois people. And I remember just like, not even connecting that, like, that's me. That's my heritage. That's my family they're talking about. But, like, it lasted for, I think, a chapter in fourth grade. We learned about, like, the Haudenosaunee, the Aztecs, the Mayans, and the Incas. And, like, that was it. We learned about, like, pre-colonial history. And then just abruptly stopped talking about Native peoples. And it felt really minimizing. I was looking forward as just a child to learn more about my history. And as an adult, I've had to really push to like learn more of my history on my own, just so I can understand how did we get here? Where are we now? And where are we heading?
As we head for our only break of the hour in just a moment, I will say that, you know, as a Clevelander who watched this debate about, well, you can't take away the name the Indians. They've always been the Indians. Interestingly, they weren't even always the Indians. They were the Spiders. They were the Naps, named after Napoleon Lajoie, one of their early players. Cleveland was a lot of things. They became the Indians, and now they're not. And a lot of sort of online warriors told me, you know, keyboard warriors told me, well, I'll never go back to games. This team is going to fall apart. The Cleveland Guardians this year, in their second year of existence as the Guardians, had a 40% increase of attendance this year. So
I will say one elder said to me, he says, I don't care if they call themselves Indians. We don't call ourselves Indians. We call ourselves by our own traditional names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I again, wide range of opinion, but mm-hmm. Guardians are doing just fine. They're not going to be in the playoffs, but that's all right. We're going to come back from our only break of the hour. We're going to be talking about an event that that Kay wants to make sure the community knows is happening at Ganundagan coming up in a couple of Sundays. Kay Gilbert is with us, and Kay is a retired teacher, and she's going to talk about her music career and the work that's happening now. The Ayapaha event coming up, we're going to talk about that. And Lungwa Lagunha Dube is with us, and Loon is the sensitivity reader for Salt and Sage Books. And we'll come right back and talk to them next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Have you ever thought that different generations, people of different ages, just don't understand you? Maybe you're a little bit older, you think younger adults don't understand you, or you don't understand them, or maybe vice versa. There's always cultural change, and there's a new project aiming to bring people together more, spend more time, and cross those differences, and we're going to talk about it on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kay Wilbert is too nice to correct me, but Kay Wilbert is one of our guests here. Really, I'm really enjoying this conversation. Loon is someone I've known them for a number of years now.
Yep.
Been a few years since you've been on this program. Kay, I really have really appreciated getting to know, because what we have found this week, as we've talked about Indigenous Peoples Day, is there are, you know, a number of teachers and retired teachers in local districts. And you know, we were talking to Trish, who teaches at Harley yesterday, and it's just really interesting to hear how a school district has changed when you do have Native representation. When we talk about representation matters, we know that from a 2016 survey that WXXI did, there is, I mean, it's not a secret, but the actual physical numbers of non-white teachers, and not to center white people, but I'm just talking about literally every other category, was, you know, four different local school districts in 2016 in the Rochester area had zero black teachers out of 300 or 400 teachers. Another four had one black teacher. A number had no Indigenous teachers. Many others had very few teachers of Latino descent. So, and I could go on and on. So there isn't a whole lot of representation in teaching circles. And so it's just interesting to hear how districts are perhaps changed when you do have that on staff. And sometimes it's even just one person, which is a lot of weight, Kay. I mean, to feel like you're the one Indigenous teacher. Do you feel that weight, or do you think, look, you know, so it goes? Do you get used to that?
I think I felt it a little bit. It entirely depended on the reaction I got from people I was with and how much they really wanted to talk to me about the Native issues and the advocacy work I was in. If they were not wanting to and ignoring it, then I felt pretty lonely. But I was really pretty surrounded with a lot of support, so that made it really, really special.
What's coming up two Sundays from now at Ganundagan?
The Iapaha Native American Music and Dance Concert, which is at 3 p.m. at the Seneca Art and Cultural Center at Ganundagan.
3 p.m. Two Sundays from now. Tell us all about what's coming up on it.
Daystar Rosalie Jones is a Native American choreographer, and she has three of her own pieces that she is presenting from her own dance company. And then the Eastman's Community Music School Adult Quintet is playing three pieces by Native American composers. And then we are collaborating on a fourth piece by Dr. Lewis Ballard called Ritmo Indio, the Rhythm of Indian America.
So it's starting at 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. Out at the Arts and Culture Center at Ganundagan. Mm-hmm. I know that they would love to see everyone there. It's the day before Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yes.
And, you know, what would you, for someone who has not experienced not just Iapaha, but Native dance and music, what should they expect?
I would say come with an open mind and come not expecting necessarily to hear or see what you've heard before. Don't expect to see anything stereotypical. Although we will, one of the pieces does end with a hoop dance, which is pretty common among Native communities. The music is not at all what you're used to hearing in Western music. Really different styles of melody. The tonal center, the rhythm, very, very unusual.
And really talented people. In fact, when Kay and I were talking earlier this week, you wanted to make sure people understood just the level of talent that we have with the choreography and the people involved.
Mm-hmm. Rosalie is an internationally recognized choreographer. Mm-hmm. She's done a lot of work in Canada and in Europe, particularly in the West. Had a career in the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and she was actually a colleague of Dr. Lewis Ballard. The Native composers have had many, many awards. Dr. Ballard himself was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. So it's just been a really interesting and wonderful group of people to connect with.
So let me grab Fred's phone call, and then we're going to connect what's going on with the Iapaha back to the subject of storytelling and who's telling the stories and what voices are heard. And we're going to come back to that in a moment. Let me get Fred in Rochester next. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. This coming November at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the induction ceremonies for this year's inductees is the Native American Link Ray, who was featured, matter of fact, it was the opening feature on a documentary that's actually been on Channel 21 a number of times called, it's a documentary of called Rumble, which was a song that Link wrote and performed called Rumble, How Indians Rocked the World. And it's a history of Native American sounds, rhythms, and culture that came in to rock and roll, as well as perhaps more so into the blues, when Native sounds were and drum beats were prohibited. The music got into American culture. And so Link Ray, the song Rumble was an instrumental, but it was banned because it was too provocative, and it was thought to have been some of the inspiration behind Elvis and his provocative movements on stage. So if anybody gets a chance to see it, it's an incredible documentary. And I'm going to be actually going down to the Barclays Center and for two reasons. One is to see Link Ray get inducted as an innovator, and to see Al Kooper, who formed Blood, Sweat, and Tears back in the early 60s, and I've been a huge fan of his, like, almost forever. But, I mean, it was that documentary. It's on, every once in a while it shows up on WXXI TV, so if you get a chance to see it, go see it. It's incredible.
Fred, thank you very much. Kay, anything you want to add there? Is that new to you, or do you know that story? Yeah,
it's new to me, but I think it's interesting how Native talented Native people have found their ways into all areas of the arts, and musically, certainly through rock, through jazz, through country western, classical music. They've just really made their mark, and we're more and more recognizing that.
Fred, thank you for that. I appreciate that phone call. It's 844-295-TALK. Listeners, if you want to weigh in, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. So some of what brought us together for this particular conversation was the new Scorsese film that is coming out, Killers of the Flower Moon. It was a hit at the Cannes Film Festival. And Leonardo DiCaprio is one of the stars. He has said that he wanted to be part of this film because he believed in Scorsese's vision of being as raw and honest as possible when it comes to the Osage murders that happened predominantly in the 1920s. And one of the things that struck me was that DiCaprio said that there are stories that indigenous communities know well that most non-indigenous Americans know very little or nothing about. And they put this on that list. And Kay, you said that you think that's mostly true. You think that's a good way to describe the Osage murders?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So when you're growing up, as you did in Oklahoma, you grew up in
I grew up here.
You grew up in here, and then you
worked? My mother grew up in Oklahoma.
Oh, with family in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. What is the story? What is the understanding there of Osage? Because one of the things that Scorsese says is that in some ways this is a typical American story of resources, stealing the resources, discovery of oil, being willing to take it no matter who dies, et cetera. I mean, is that roughly the way you understand the story?
Well, from what I've read, there are many, many very, very sad stories very similar to this. I don't know about murders of this extent mm-hmm. in other tribes,
right.
But I have read about children who were Native children who were orphaned, and they had been assigned a white guardian, and they were actually very wealthy, but the guardian was taking all the money, and these children were living out in the woods in a hollow tree begging for food. So I've read about stories like that. I think there was a lot of just the mindset of assimilation, push these people aside, take whatever you can take.
Are you surprised that Hollywood is willing to kind of tell this kind of a story now?
I'm surprised, but I'm more relieved to feel that these people really want to honestly tell what the Native people are telling them. History is passed down from, you know, father to son, mother to daughter, grandmother to grandchild. That's how history is passed down extensively in the Native community through stories, mm-hmm. our family stories. And they listen to each other. We listen to each other. But it's very common for us to not feel listened to by the dominant culture. So now that these actors and they're hiring Native actors in these roles and listening to what Native people are telling them when they're writing the stories, I'm very relieved and very, very pleased about that.
Kay's right, Loon, that there are Native actors. There are Natives as part of the production and writing staff. So I don't, you know, I'm certainly not privy to all of the decisions that were made into how a story like this gets told. I mentioned the film writer Les Friedman told me this morning that he read the book Killers of the Flower Moon and immediately thought someone in Hollywood is going to turn this into a movie. It's such a powerful story. He didn't think it was going to be Scorsese. And so I want to start by asking you, you know, what is your expectation or hope that the people behind this film did to make sure that this wasn't another film where, you know, you have white people playing Native roles, you don't have, you know, consultation on script or history, et cetera. What do you think should have happened to make this what it needs to be?
Oh, that requires a lot of knowledge of filmmaking that I might not have, but I'd hope that Native people would just in general be listened to and asked for their input directly into the storytelling process, whether that be through script consultation or even writing the script. I'd hope that actors would be consulted on like whether they're whether or not they're comfortable with, you know, certain portrayals. But it is, it's hard for me to decide, or for me to say, like, much more than that.
Okay, that's fair enough. Then there's the aspect of the of a film that is not primarily, but first and foremost, a film that's going to be successful has to be, for lack of a better word, entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be uncomfortable when it is telling tragic stories of attempted genocide or community murder that went on for years. So how do you kind of square that up with, hey, there's still a sort of a societal value here if this is the vehicle to making sure people are aware of these stories?
I think it's acceptable, with a question mark. We do have stories that are just very tragic as entertainment. I think, to lean on my mother's side for a second, Jojo Rabbit was a really fantastic film about a very terrible topic, the Holocaust.
Yes.
And I think they managed to balance it really well with saying, like, here is, like, the horror of that time period in Germany. And also without it being, like, the most horrible things that happened. It wasn't, for lack of a better term, trauma porn.
I hear that. What do you think, Kay? I mean, this is a film that's probably going to make a good amount of money. It is technically a piece of fiction, but it's historical fiction, and it's supposed to be based pretty closely to the historical record. Are you okay with that? I mean, studios are going to make money. People are going to make money. Scorsese is going to make money. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, I think that we also can learn from these stories. So if they're being historically accurate and the depictions throughout the film, whether it's the costuming or the music or the language that's the Osage language that's spoken, if it's culturally accurate, then it can be something that people are learning from. And lots of times people will take away films and it'll stay with them and they will remember it. So it is affecting them in that way.
Well, looking at other works and Loon shared just a short list, for example. So if you're looking at literature, books that are, I think, in your view, doing a pretty good job, Making Love with the Land by Joshua Whitehead, The Six World Series by Rebecca Roanhorse. You mentioned Braiding Sweetgrass, which is, you know, we've had the author on this program, and a lot of people, I think, have been moved by some of the themes there. Those are just a few to flag. And the on the movie side, Prey.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Oh, Prey was fantastic. I honestly
Prey.
Yes,
Prey. Prey.
Yeah. I honestly think the studios probably felt a little regretful that they didn't put it into mainstream, movie theater release because it did so well on Hulu.
Recent film?
Yeah. Probably 2022.
Okay.
21. Mm-hmm. It was part of the Predator franchise. It's about
I was aware of it, but I was not aware of any sort of indigenous connection.
It centers around is she Cheyenne? It's been a little bit since I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
But it centers on a Native woman, and the startling thing about it is it's a sci-fi film. It's about, like, an alien coming to Earth, hunting people, and it centers Native people in that. It talks about colonialism. It is very unflattering to colonialism, which is, like, uplifting for me to see. it does something different. I mean, I think so often when we see stories of Native people, they're historic, and there's nothing wrong with telling the history because, you know, Killers of the Flower Moon, those stories are important. They need to be told. People need to hear them. But that's also not all we are. You know, we talk a lot about how Native people aren't just historical fictions. And that means, like, we need to have stories like Prey that, like, you know, put us into a fantasy setting. Or we need stories like Reservation Dogs, which, like, show us in a contemporary sense. And Rutherford Falls, for example, too.
Those are two on the list that are really highly regarded.
Mm-hmm.
You like them both?
I love them both, yes.
Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Reservation Dogs just wrapped, I think. I was saying Will Cleveland was tweeting about this, saying he loved it. And that's kind of what caught my attention this week with Reservation Dogs. Got your endorsement.
Yes, it does. And I think more importantly, it has endorsements of like friends of mine who grew up on the res. I grew up outside the res. I was in suburbia in Florida. But friends of mine have said, like, this is a show that, like, shows what reservation life really is. And it's comedy, it's tragedy, it's a mix of the two. And, like, they blend together in, like, a really hard-to-capture way.
And to your point about sort of the power of storytelling and writing and also who gets to tell the stories, some of the critics, the native critics I've read who've been writing about Reservation Dogs say that this is really written for native audiences. There are jokes and sort of little winks to the audience that native audiences will appreciate, which is unusual for, you know, the history of Hollywood and entertainment. So.
Yeah. I mean, so much is done for the white gaze that, like, you know, we don't see stuff for us, frankly.
So that's one. Have you seen Reservation Dogs?
I've wanted to, but I haven't.
Yeah, a lot of love for that one. Okay, so as we wrap here, Kay Wilbert, we'll see all of our listeners out on at Ganondagan on Sunday, October 8th. That is two Sundays from now at 3:00 in the afternoon. It's at the Art and Culture Center there, and they would love to see you there. It's going to be music and dance and a great cultural experience. Thank you for telling that story and being here. And please do come back and share your wisdom with us, Kay.
Thank you.
That's Kay Wilbert. And our thanks as well to Lungwa Lagoon Hadubi, who is, Loon is a sensitivity reader for Salt and Sage Books. Thanks for being here and sharing your perspective as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from the whole team at Connections, Evan and Megan saying thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.